Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. What's up? If you're the parent of a child between the ages of 12 and 15, a middle school child, that's the question, but what's the answer? Please. Decoding what makes today's tweens tick is a parent's and teacher's biggest challenge and, some days, worst nightmare. Those baby bundles of joy are now swathed in raging hormones, angst, and palpitating fear that you will embarrass them in front of friends. This summer, the movie 13 offered a glimpse inside this world.
No, Mom, it's okay. You can just drop us off and then go on an errand or something.
Oh. Okay. I guess that'll be all right, maybe for an hour. I have to talk to Evie's mom, though.
Mom, please don't do this to me. This is the best day of my life. I'll kill you if you embarrass me.
So, what's really going on behind the braces and bravado? Writer Linda Perlstein went back to middle school to find out. The education reporter for the Washington Post spent a year at Wild Lake Middle School in suburban Maryland, talking, listening, instant messaging. She has written a new book about the experience called Not Much, Just Chillin', The Hidden Lives of Middle Schoolers. Are you riding the middle school roller coaster with your children? What's your survival strategy? What do you imagine is going on inside those middle school walls, those middle school minds? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Linda Perlstein, education reporter for The Washington Post. Her eye-opening book is Not Much, Just Chillin'. Good evening and welcome, Linda Perlstein.
Good evening to you.
Thanks for being with us. And with me in the studio tonight, On Point News analyst Randall Kennedy, professor at Harvard Law School. Randall Kennedy, good to see you.
Good to be here.
Linda Perlstein, first of all, how did you do this? You spent a year at a middle school. It sounds like a kind of, not everybody's idea of a great time, but you dived right in. How did you blend in or get into this world deep enough to figure out what was going on?
Well, first, I guess if you saw me, you might think it wasn't quite the challenge you'd imagine. I'm pretty small, and
so you're a pipsqueak.
Occasionally mistaken. Let's just say I get carted when I go out. I usually don't get carted at our movies, though.
And so. did you literally go into the school and go to class with the kids? How did you do your work?
Yeah, I mean, I rented out my home in Washington. I moved a half mile away from the school. I rode my bike to school every day, and I went to class. I went to lunch. I went to the roller skating rink. I went to the boy-girl parties. I went to the birthday parties. I went to the swim practices. I sat and watched kids do homework in their living rooms, and I did that for a year.
So you did it. And you've come out with a glimpse of a realm that can be awfully mysterious, kind of closed to adults trying to look in. What's the headline from your year in middle school, Linda Perlstein?
Well, the kids are all right, but they're kind of confused. I think they have a lot more to deal with than I did 20 years ago when I was in middle school. I don't think the headline is shocking, as some might have it. But I think people would be surprised to learn, you know, how much these kids do carry on their shoulders and how much, you know, kind of strange, confusing information they have to process.
We can just imagine that, but imagining how they process it is something else. We're hoping that you'll share a lot of stories with us tonight, Linda, just of what you saw, of what made a mark on your memory and your observation there. You know, there's a lot of apprehension about how the kids are doing. I wonder if we can just kind of dive in here and ask you on a few different subjects and get you to illustrate what you learned at your time in middle school that might help us understand. You know, we talked about the movie 13 at the top of the hour, and of course, I don't know how many of our listeners have seen it, but there was a lot of trouble in that movie. Dysfunctional family, but dysfunctional kids. Sex, drugs, mutilation of their own bodies, you know, binge, purge, out of control life. Let's jump right in with that. What about sex and relationships? What stories did you see? What behavior did you see? What's the picture in middle school?
Well, the movie 13, which I thought was a very good movie, certainly is not the typical experience, even for kids at the extreme in many middle schools. The girl in there who in 5 months goes from good girl to bad girl in just about every way you can imagine is not typical in kind of the degree of what she's doing, but I don't think it's totally uncommon for a kid to go through a lot of changes at that age, to try out a lot of behaviors that they didn't try before. I think the theme in that movie of a child, kind of a mother losing her grip on her child, so much as that particular mother ever had it, and the mother kind of not wanting to face the changes and not wanting to kind of crack down on her daughter for fear of pushing her away, are pretty common themes, even if the actual activities are not. I mean, not a lot of kids in middle school are, for example, having sex, you know. But at the same time,
well, we don't actually know. We kind of like to understand. Take us in, if you would, to relationships. Same-sex relationships, boy-girl relationships, sexual relationships. What did you see? What did you learn?
Well, a lot of what I saw was kind of sweetly and strangely exactly as I remembered it from 20 years ago, which is girls and boys going out doesn't mean they actually go anywhere. Doesn't even mean they necessarily talk to each other. They just kind of choose someone to like, and that person chooses them to like back, and they're kind of testing out what it means to be, in their minds, adult, or to kind of see how someone thinks about them, or to try to create an identity outside of their family, and just part of the natural hormonal process of noticing the opposite sex. So most middle schoolers fall in that range of you go out, maybe you've had according to studies I've seen, about 75% of middle schoolers, by the time they end middle school, have been kissed, okay? So
this sounds like 1959.
Well, it's, it's kind of nice to think of it that way. At the other end of the spectrum, studies vary widely, and a lot of places still don't ask kids that young about their sexual activity under the grounds that if you ask them, it might encourage them to actually do it, which is a little disappointing because then we don't really have a great picture of what's going on. But the studies that I've looked at, anywhere between 2 and 12% of kids have had sex by the time they get out of middle school, which is more than it should be. But, it's really not the vast majority of kids.
So you don't see it wild and out of control about there. What about drugs? That's the other big fear that comes up, that they're reaching into earlier years of schooling. Did you see it?
It happens. I think that teen drug use, to the best of my knowledge, is pretty much plateauing as a whole, although just like sex, which I believe is also plateauing, it's getting those who are trying it are trying it a little earlier. There was not much drug use to speak of at the school where I was at, and I certainly was in a position to know.
You were in a position to know.
Well, yeah, the kids
were
very open with me, and mm-hmm. I was there, and I was at their parties, and I was hanging out with them outside, as they lit things on fire and made themselves pass out on the playground, But to me, most of the most extreme behavior that was going on with any kind of commonness was some smoking, and I was glad to see there wasn't a whole lot of drinking and drugs.
Okay, so we've ticked off those kind of...
Which does not mean it doesn't happen everywhere.
We got it, and we've ticked off those big categories that get parents' hearts in their throats first. but you're talking here about the hidden lives of middle schoolers. What's hidden?
Well, if you take any of those areas, there are aspects where they're not doing the big thing, but they know far more about its existence than kids did 20 or even 10 years ago. I mean, if you look at sex, middle schoolers, for the most part, are not having sex, but they have come up in a fairly sexualized environment. Many of them, watch things on TV or hear things or listen to music that's very sexualized, and they've kind of in this in-between stage of saying, I'll give you an example. There's some girls I know who say, well, I'm saving myself for marriage. Okay, so they come from that very, traditional attitude.
And they're saying
sexuality.
That in middle school.
Yeah, but that at the same time, a boy might hit him on the butt, and they don't haul off and slap him because they say, well, it's just a butt. So they're in between this whole, like, it's a big deal and it's not a big deal, and they're not sure, you know, where they stand.
Hidden lives. It is the age where parents begin to ask their children what's going on, and the answer seems somehow insufficient, that it doesn't really cover what's going on. What did you see about communication between middle schoolers and their parents?
Well, a lot of kids, when they get to middle school, don't share as much with their kids as they used to. It's not the case with every kid, but most kids clam up to a degree in middle school. They feel like there are a few things going on. They feel like they should be able to handle things themselves. A lot of kids told me they didn't want their parents to know what was really going on at school because their parents might pull them out and send them to private school, as if, you know, as if their parents couldn't possibly handle what they had to tell them. Or
but this
would
isn't
be
adding up. It does. It sounds you're describing sort of a pretty mild scene, but their parents couldn't handle it. Is this because the parents are so paranoid about anything? What's to pull the kid out over?
Well, I mean, if you're a kid and you know that kids are, you know, kissing on the school bus or something, you might think that would totally send your parents, you know, through the roof. And you don't want to burden them any more than they're already burdened. You don't want to worry them, and you don't want to shock them. And I don't think you really have a sense at age 12 of what exactly will shock your parents, because this probably isn't stuff you've talked much about with them.
Randall Kennedy, I guess what's shocking me in this conversation so far is here we are in 2003. It's the age of every sort of menace known to mankind, and it all sounds kind of benign. It sounds like it ever was.
Well, one can certainly take comfort from the very first sentence that Linda Perlstein spoke to us. The kids are all right. Confused, but all right. It does sound pretty benign. In fact, a little bit too benign. For instance, this was a suburban school. What about urban schools? What about rural schools? These kids, we just heard that parents might think of taking their kids out of this particular school and send them to private school. Well, there are many, many, many people in the United States where private school would be completely out of the question. So I guess one thing that I'm thinking about here is how generalizable is the experience of this particular school?
Linda, what do you think? Were you in a goody-two-shoes school?
I think the school was mixed. You know, it was a for suburban school. It had a socioeconomic mix. It was half white, and it was about two-fifths affluent and one-fourth low income, and the rest somewhere in between. I think Randall's right in a sense. I mean, you can't take the experiences at one school necessarily and universalize them to the entire country. I mean, I know there are club kids in New York who I know of who are very fast, very young. I mean, the girl in 13, for example, the girl who helped write that movie, I don't doubt for a second that those things happened to her as she presents them. I just think that there are certain things that are universal about being 12 or 13, and that's what I was trying to capture in my book. Not so much that every single kid is behaving the way the kids in my book behave, but that there are some universal experiences about growing up and about early adolescence.
But when you stood next to these kids in the hallways with your petite self, did you get the feeling, gosh, this could have been a girl or a boy that I was in middle school with?
No. I mean, in certain ways, yes. In certain ways, you know, we had the same kind of silly fights among girls for no reason, and people can, you know, the way middle schoolers can be very mean to each other, that was the same as it was, and certainly the crush thing was the same. But, you know, I never had a boy grinding against my butt while we danced in the cafeteria, which a lot of kids now, you know, have to think about.
We'll come back and catch up with that. Linda Perlstein, stand by. She's with us, the author of Not Much, Just Chillin', The Hidden Lives of Middle Schoolers. We're talking about those middle schoolers tonight and what's on their minds, their social schedules, their instant messaging screens. Are you on the middle school roller coaster with your child? And what's your strategy for surviving Middle School. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the hidden lives of middle schoolers and what's on their minds, their social schedules, their instant messaging screens. Our guest is Linda Perlstein. She's education reporter for The Washington Post and author of the new book, Not Much, Just Chillin', The Hidden Lives of Middle Schoolers. You can join us as well. What do you think is going on inside those middle school minds? And if you ask, do they tell you, do the kids open up? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Linda, you were just talking about social life in school, dancing in school. There's a passage here I wonder if you'd read to us from page 89, if you've got the book there, about mixing it up at Wild Lake Middle School.
This is the day of the first school dance of the year. At 12:35, the students are released one grade at a time from the classes where they can no longer pay attention to the gym, where lights flash and music plays and fog spills across the room. The sixth graders are excited about their first middle school dance and enter the room slowly and surely. The seventh graders are excited to freak, or to see who else freaks, or at the very least see their friends and request their songs. The eighth graders act like they aren't excited about anything. Everyone cool has time out, one says. For the first 20 minutes, everybody clumps in groups and watches, moving almost imperceptibly to the music, lip gloss wands emerging for duty. One fat boy breakdances, and everyone laughs at his jiggle. In the corner, eighth-grade boys stand around a chair and look down on it. They swear it is moving by itself. Then the DJ calls out, "How many of you know the booty call?" Ah, the line dance, the perfect dance for middle school, since the law of preteen dancing mandates that you cannot move your limbs in any way differently from anyone else. Here the steps and their exact sameness are laid out for you. The seventh grade boys start a brief hyper conga line. The electric slide gets just about everybody dancing. At Clint Eastwood, things get slow and six couples are urged together by their friends. They clutch each other awkwardly, boys shorter than girls, one bold enough to pet his partner's back. Nearly everyone else leaves the room because it's a gay song. There are rap songs that send all the white kids to the cafeteria and power pop songs that send all the black kids to the cafeteria. There are a few songs like DMX's Party Up that hold everyone's attention, get them bouncing, get a few of them freaking. One bold person, usually a boy, goes for it. He grinds his butt into the behind of whatever girl is handy, or maybe he jokingly freaks his guy friend, or humps the floor. A few kids join in. A circle grows around the dancers to protect them from the teachers who stream through the gym, sniffing out inappropriateness. But the teachers are swift at getting right in the middle of it, nipping the freak in the bud.
So, freaking. This is something, Linda, that presumably they weren't doing at your middle school.
You know, at my middle school, we had Miss Louise O'Brien come Monday afternoons after school, and she taught us the waltz and the box step in preparation for bar mitzvahs, and the boys had to go up to the girls and say, "May I have this dance?" I did not see anyone asking, "May I have this dance?" Although I can't say we really wound up doing that either, but we did try the box step.
Randall Kennedy, here's a difference, and it emerges. I mean, there's just a, Linda says, there's just a greater candor, a culture of sexuality that these kids live in, that they're kind of used to.
Well, yeah, that's certainly the report we're getting, and there are other indications of that. I'm always a little bit leery about nostalgia, though. When we make comparisons about today and 20 years ago, I mean, if we go back 20 years ago, I wonder, I'm sure that there was some excellent reporter who took a look at junior high school or middle school, as it's being called. I wonder how big the differences really would be.
You mean things got hot and heavy all
sure.
over?
Sure. I mean,
the time.
Then I mean,
one
I,
way or another.
When I think of middle school, I think of dances, and we called it, slow dancing. There was a bit of grinding.
Well, I made out with my share of boys in middle school dances, but you know, we faced each other, it's not so much to say that, you know, the kids aren't, we weren't romantic or sexual in some sort of way at the time, but I just think there's a kind of shift in the level of intimacy. I mean, there were points where I wished the kids would have kind of turned around and made out with each other, rather than just kind of go up to one girl one by one and kind of grind against their back. I mean, I think there is both a qualitative and a quantitative difference to some of the things that are going on now.
The anthropologist would surely see something different going on there. We're talking about the hidden lives of middle schoolers. I want to invite callers into our conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Roby's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Roby. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you this
Great,
evening?
Thanks. Great.
I was listening to the program on the way home, and I'm a school counselor in Buffalo, and have been in the same school for 8 years.
What level of school, Roby?
It's middle school this year.
Okay.
Our school is under renovation, so actually we're pre-K through 8th grade.
So what are you hearing? Does this sound familiar to you or not?
Yeah, it sounds very familiar. I mean, the point that I want to make, I mean, I've dealt with pregnancies in, the
middle school
high.
Pregnancies? Okay, yeah.
Junior high,
yeah.
And we deal with it very, very sensitively. But the point I really want to make is parental involvement is extremely important in a child's life.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we take a team approach at our school. You know, the school becomes the teachers involved, and then it gets passed on to me. And we draw in from all different expertises within the school. We have a total team approach to whatever problems we're dealing with.
But you're a counselor, and you're saying parental involvement is the first, the top of your list. What do you see? How does that break down? If kids have it, what? If they don't have it, what?
I think if a child has parental support, it really, really engages the child wholeheartedly. I mean, there's a lot of kids that I deal with that, you know, the whole family's involved, but the kid is like maybe with mom and then sometimes with grandma. But if we have no involvement from the parent and the community, forces too, the child is set up to fail. And that's what we try to prevent.
Are you talking about latchkey kids with nobody at home? Middle schoolers,
they don't
go to aftercare programs. They come home. Is that when it starts to matter if there's someone there?
Some of them are latchkey. Some of them go to daycare. You know, moms have to work if they're single moms.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, if you're not aware as a parent of what your child is doing, it's very, very difficult. I mean, often the child acts one way at home and comes into school, gets involved with the peer group, and then we have a whole different behavior. And often the parents that I see are surprised about the way their kids are acting, and then they deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, we engage the parent as often as possible.
Roby, we've got it, and you've opened up a great continent for us. Thanks for your call. Linda Perlstein, you write a lot about parents and different styles of parental involvement. Take us into that world.
Well, first I just want to mention something about, she just said, you know, the parents often are surprised. Kids at that age are very different sometimes at school than they are at home and vice versa. And that's why I felt really lucky, is because I got to see them in both worlds. I mean, there were kids I knew who were quiet as could be at school, whose parents couldn't believe it because, you know, the kid doesn't shut up at home in the church group or whatever. And there were kids who were such troublemakers at school who, you know, were perfectly fine at home. And I think that's pretty common. As far as parental involvement is concerned, meaningful parental involvement, and I'm sure Mrs. Thomas will, the principal of the school, will second this later when she comes on, is possibly the most important, you know, factor in whether a kid does well in middle school. And I don't just mean kind of does well, you know, on their schoolwork, just does well as a whole person. And doesn't just mean kind of showing up at the field trips, but really making your child feel part of something, being there for them. The biggest fallacy of middle school is that your kid, you know, is old enough to dress himself and feed himself. So, you know, why not leave him alone? And
mm-hmm.
and since that's what he seems to want anyway. And most educators would tell you that's the biggest mistake you can make. And if you read the stories of the kids in my book, it's pretty clear the differences between the kids whose parents were very fully involved in their daily lives and those who are more detached.
So everybody's saying be as involved as you can be. At the same time, you have some stories in here of parents who are so hyper-involved. Tell us the story of Elizabeth and her father.
Well, Elizabeth's father, Joseph, who I think is a very good man, is somewhat obsessed about her schoolwork and gets involved in every little drama that Elizabeth has at school with her teachers. And it drives her nuts, kind of being, you know, treated like this character in a book who her parents have to figure out, you know, her character motivation and everything. And they talk about her in the third person. And she comes across these emails. Her father has been trading with her viola teacher. And she feels very much not in control of her own life when she sees that. I mean, there's involvement to try to say, hey, what's going on? Is there anything I can do to help? And jumping in and trying to fight all of your kids' battles for you. A lot of kids tell me that the reason they don't tell their parents things that happen at school is because, or with their friends, is because they're afraid their parents will jump in where the kids don't want them to jump in. Now, sometimes parents, you know, very well should be, you know, the parents should be jumping in on things that the kids don't necessarily want them to. But that's part of the artful balance of being a parent of a middle schooler, is figuring out, you know, where to jump in and where to let your kid try to navigate with you as a guide, but not as a driver, if that makes any sense.
Linda, you write about this social relationships of middle schoolers, how they're evolving at that age. A lot of it sounds familiar, and yet it's always a big drama if you're in the midst of it. I know there in Washington, you're joined in the studio by one of the young people who you wrote about, now an eighth grader at Wild Lake Middle School in Maryland, who you call Mia. Mia, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Mia. How are you this evening?
I'm great. How about you?
I'm great. Have you read Linda Perlstein's book?
Yes, I have.
And do you think she captured what's going on in your middle school?
Definitely. Yeah, I wouldn't change any of it.
She's got the picture. Linda Perlstein, describe for us where Mia falls in the social life of Wild Lake Middle School.
Well, I'd have to say Mia, I haven't checked in at school with her, although we keep in close touch, so I haven't seen if this has changed much, but Mia's always been very popular. She's one of those kids, there's always one kid in every grade who's kind of popular for the right reasons. I mean, unless she was snowing me very well, Mia was pretty nice to people, and, you know, sometimes people around her could be either not nice or a little obsessed in the whole world of trying to get her attention or make sure that, you know, she liked them or make sure they retain their status in her eyes. And I think that to Mia, some of this all came as a surprise because, you know, she just saw herself as just another, you know, kid with her own problems.
So give us the texture of that social life. What do kids struggle with the most in middle school socially, so we can get a sense of how what the different threads are there?
Well, middle school is really, really where your friends start to become of utmost importance to you. And parents of middle schoolers see this all the time. They say, oh, my kid cares more about her friends than she does about me. And you really, really become focused on what your friends think of you. And so what that means is you're, you know, clothes are important your best friend is important. I mean, there's a character in my book, Lily, who is very concerned with, you know, remaining Mia's best friend. Mia had lots of best friends because that's just the kind of kid she is.
So what was going through Lily's mind when she tried or wanted to be that best friend?
Well, it was hard for her to see everyone else kind of jockeying for the attention as well, I think. And you know, she acted very differently around Mia. When Mia's other friends were there, she acted, you know, she could be a very shy girl, but when Mia was around, it was very exciting for her. I like to call it a girl crush, a completely platonic crush, where it's just like, you know, you're kind of smitten in a sense with a person. You just want to be around them. You get excited when you're around them. And I think it can be overwhelming for the focus of all that attention sometimes.
Mia, it sounds like you spent some time in a good situation there. I wonder, from your perspective, you know a lot of kids in the school, you know the kinds of things their parents are concerned about, you know the kind of conversations that the middle schoolers have with their parents. What do you think's being shared and not being shared between students and parents at that age?
Well, I basically tell my mom everything that happens with me at school, and sometimes kids don't tell their parents, like, if they are going out with somebody or if they've kissed a boy or something, and some kids drink and some kids go out to parties, and I don't really like getting involved with that, but some kids just don't like having their parents in their lives.
Is it because of the way their parents try to interact with them, do you think, or because the kids are just doing things they don't want their parents to know about?
Well, both. I grew up with a very close relationship with my mom and dad, and I don't know if all kids have that. I doubt it, but I think I'm really lucky to have my parents so involved with my life.
Sounds like you are. Let me get a call. Kirsten's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Kirsten. Whoops. Kirsten sounds like has bugged off there. Paul's calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I was just, and I was hearing the original comments. I was almost outraged at just thinking about it. It seemed like you were looking for some specific sort of outrageous new sexual activity or something else that was... It was very new or unique in this environment.
Oh, I hope I hope not. It's just that that gets thrown up so much that we thought we'd just go straight at it with Linda Perlstein. But you think that's exaggerated in accounts of middle school life, Paul?
It definitely, obviously from my own years in middle school, you know, in the early 70s there, there was a lot of stuff going on that you certainly didn't want to come home and talk to your parents about. But as you look at, I just find that today with my own kids that are in the middle school age, you know, there's a lot of the classic stuff going on that has always been happening in terms of finding your own way and, you know, learning about relationships with others. But and there's always a sexual overtone that maybe sort of more... exacerbated by television and movies today, but I don't feel that, you know, there's something shocking or unique going on in those environments as much as kids are growing up.
Well, a little more bumping and grinding, but it looks familiar to you. Paul, we're coming up on a break, but I thank you for your call. Randall Kennedy, that was kind of your point, that in a way this sounds familiar.
Well, I hope that's the case, and frankly, I think that that is a message that is itself newsworthy, insofar as the news media often tries to trumpet the bad and make us think that the apocalypse is around the corner. This might be a very nice corrective.
Good for it if it is. We're talking tonight about the hidden lives of middle schoolers and what's on their minds, their social schedules, their instant messaging screens. Do these stories sound familiar to you? Could this be your school, your child? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about middle schoolers tonight with Linda Perlstein. She's education reporter for the Washington Post. She spent a year in middle schoolers in middle school. She came out of it with a new book entitled Not Much, Just Chillin', The Hidden Lives of Middle Schoolers. You can join the conversation. What are you hearing? What's new in middle school and what's not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. We're joined now from Columbia, Maryland, by Brenda Thomas, who is principal at Wild Lake Middle School, where Linda Perlstein spent her year. She's been principal there for the last 5 years and an educator for 25 years. Good evening and welcome, Principal Thomas.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Not at all.
You've got 25 years perspective on this, and we're looking for what the arc looks like here tonight. What do you see over that time that's new with kids, that's new in middle school?
Well, not all of my 25 years has been in middle school. I would have to say probably the last 10 to 15 years have been middle school oriented.
Right, and five is principal.
I would have to say that I actually think, to tell you the truth, middle school kids are better than when I started in terms of their behavior and our expectations for them.
Now, that's terrific. Tell us more.
I have to say there's a wide range, though. I mean, there are, I would say, most of our kids are very age-appropriate, and they're not into things. I think that part of the reason they hide things from their parents is because they're becoming more independent people, period, and they're trying to handle more things on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And they do experiment with different social groups because generally they're put into a situation where there are more social groups for them to choose from, because in elementary school it's a pretty small environment. And then they go into middle school and it's a larger environment and they meet a whole lot of different types of people generally. And they're experimenting with new friends and new social groups.
And maybe even new personalities.
And definitely
themselves.
New personalities, yes, which a lot of parents are just not prepared for when they encounter it for the first time.
And so maybe they don't let them encounter those personalities. We've talked a lot about social relationships tonight. But what about the learning, Brenda Thomas? You're the principal. There's been a lot of emphasis on testing and standardized tests and learning. What's your sense about the quality of learning going on?
Well, I would have to say that there is so much growth going on at this level. The early adolescent time is a very difficult time for students, and they're growing in every possible way, physically, emotionally, intellectually, mm-hmm. socially, and intellectually, generally. They're moving into the range of abstract thinking by the time they're 12 or 13 years old. And I think the important thing for us as educators is to make sure that those students are engaged in the classroom.
Linda Prosty, let me ask you, what did you see? Did you see students who were engaged? Were they warehoused? Were they taught to the test? Were they engaged?
Well, I don't think warehoused would ever be quite the right word. At least at Wild Lake, you know, there was a range. You know, there were some teachers who really managed to you know, these kids need very kind of engaged and hands-on, and they need to have some role in their learning. And there were some teachers who did that really well. There were some teachers who were kind of stuck in old ways of reading aloud to the kids out of textbooks. And, you know, you could see the difference in the way the kids did their work for the class, the way the kids behaved in the class. And, you know, all the teachers cared very much. They just had different, you know, they just have different levels of ability to adapt to that particular age student, which is, you know, teachers mostly come into middle school from a background of having studied to be an elementary school teacher or a high school teacher. And there's not a whole lot out there that teaches you specifically to be a middle school teacher. And I think that's a problem because, you know, there are things, as Brenda said, that are specific to these kids and the way that they're developing, that it would be nice for people to understand very well when they come in to teach them. And some people do a great job of that.
And Principal Thomas, you say, and we're delighted to hear it, that the kids are better. Give us a sense of the dimensions in which you find them better than a few years back.
Well, I think when I first started, because I taught at Wild Lake Middle School several years ago before I came back to be the principal, but I do remember early on when I started there, and that must have been probably 15 years ago, there were kids that I encountered on a pretty regular basis who were, you know, who were into things like drugs, and it was pretty overt in the school. There was smoking in the bathrooms. There was, I mean, not that never happens, but, I mean, on a much more regular basis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, there were, and not to say that this never happens anywhere, but certainly there were, I remember, a few students, a couple of girls who I remember who were pregnant in middle school.
So from where you stand, it looks like they've cleaned up their act.
And right, I don't really encounter that kind of thing in our school, and we have an incredibly diverse population. I have taught in a lot of socioeconomic environments, and I have to say that sometimes I find that when students are in an upper socioeconomic environment, they tend to be more exposed to things earlier than students who are you know, in a very mixed environment.
Mm. Well, we've got one slice that we've looked at through Linda Prostein's book, but what a fascinating glimpse. Brenda Thomas, principal at Wild Lake Middle School, thanks for being with us tonight.
Sure.
And Mia, have a great eighth grade. I hope it turns out just fabulously for you. Keep going.
Thanks.
And Linda Prostein, thanks for the time you spent there, and thanks for sharing your insights with us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Linda Prostein is author of the new book, Not Much, Just Chillin', The Hidden Lives of Middle Schoolers. Randall Kennedy, it sounds like the kids are all right. We're going to keep our antenna out here. It's a big world.
Well, this is a very important subject, and certainly one of the great virtues of Linda Prostein's book is that she looks directly at what's going on and gives a very deep description. Let's hope that her view is an accurate one.
We'll carry that hope, Randall Kennedy. Thanks for being with us tonight. In a moment, remembering Edward Said, this is On Point. Edward Said, America's most prominent advocate for the Palestinian cause, died today in New York City. He was 67. A scholar and literary critic, he is best known for the 1978 book Orientalism, a searing criticism of the West and its understanding of Arab culture. He also wrote passionately about the Palestinians and other subjects, from English literature, his academic specialty, to music and culture. His most inflammatory moment came in 2000 when he was photographed throwing a rock toward an Israeli guardhouse on the Lebanese border. The aging scholar said the rock was not thrown at anyone, but that it was a symbolic act of solidarity. Columbia University Humanities Professor Gayatri Spivak was a friend and colleague of Said's for 30 years. In this radio diary, she remembers the life and legacy of Edward Said, including his rejection of a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
He thought that the way to go would be, and indeed as an Indian, I have very strong feelings about this, that to divide the country in terms of generally and basically religious orientation is not a good idea. And strategy was not always something that came to the forefront of his considerations, that although strategically it might seem like a solution, first of all, the solution itself would definitely be tilted. And secondly, in the long run, to divide the country would not lead to good political consequences. In terms of Middle Eastern politics, it's an extraordinarily courageous voice. But I think from the point of view of literary criticism, we've lost someone who actually gave a whole new turn to the way literary criticism is done. With his book, 1978 book, Orientalism, he made literary critics aware of the way in which Europe, during and after the colonial period, constructed something which it called the Orient, and it was in terms of this construction that it understood in politics and in intellectual production the world that it colonized. He was actually a light-hearted person. He was so concerned about the serious things of the world and took such care to express his opinions courageously, but in private life, he was a lot of fun. This is something that I think people find it difficult to imagine. He was a very sweet man and full of, I mean, that's why that rock throwing, I can so understand that as a kind of prank. He certainly was not doing it to hurt or harm anyone. It was a gesture that kind of said, in the way in which a literary person can say, look, by this act, I align myself with you. These are from his 1993 Reith lectures, which were given in Britain. And I think this passage where Professor Said is describing the intellectual describes him very well. And now I quote, "The intellectual is an individual with a specific public role in society that cannot be reduced simply to being a faceless professional, a competent member of a class just going about her or his business. The intellectual is an individual endowed with a faculty for representing, embodying, articulating a message, a philosophy or opinion to as well as for a public. It cannot be played without a sense of being someone whose place it is to publicly raise embarrassing questions, to confront orthodoxy and dogma, rather than to produce them, to represent all those people and issues that are routinely forgotten or swept under the rug. There is no such thing as a private intellectual. Since the moment you set down words and then publish them, you have entered the public world. And I think this really captures the way Edward Said was to his students and to the world. And I think his landmark quality was courage.
Gayatri Spivak is professor of humanities at Columbia University and a longtime friend of Edward Said. We'll close tonight with an excerpt from one of Said's last speeches entitled Iraq and American Identity. He delivered the address on May 8th at the University of Washington in Seattle.
Every empire in its official discourse says that it is not an empire, that it's different, and that it has the unique history and power to do things for culture and civilization and democracy that no one has attempted before. Lodged at the very heart of the official American undertaking in the Middle East is the same imperialist thing, except that Bush, Rumsfeld, and the others have a media and many intellectuals who have internalized the official and much reiterated theme of American altruism and beneficence and never question or are bothered by what it is that we do. That is why one is grateful for occasional glimmers of edifying honesty, such as was offered recently by Michael Ledeen, a member of the Pentagon's advisory group and a veteran of the Iran-Contra scandal, now the holder of the Freedom Chair at the American Enterprise Institute. I quote, "Every 10 years or so," he says, "the United States needs to pick up some small, crappy little country and throw it against the wall just to show the world we mean business." In fact, however, most of us are lied to and manipulated. The case against Iraq as warranting an enormously expensive and destructive war, now estimated at about $80 or $90 billion, was, in my opinion, entirely confected to conceal and disguise the two reasons that wars are usually fought for: material interests and conquest. Besides, who assigned us the role of bringing democracy to Iraq? Every American needs to ask that question. Every American needs to ask that question very seriously. Beyond the self-glorification of our totally self-invented mission, the real reasons for this war were oil and domination. Ask yourself the question, if Iraq had been the world's largest exporter of oranges, would there have been a war?
Edward Said, from a May 8th lecture delivered at the University of Washington, Edward Said died today in New York City. He was 67. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Alina Mata, Julie Jupp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Sarah Cook and John Parati. Special thanks to Robert Frazier in Washington. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.